Hello and welcome to the Fergan. My name is Dan and I'm here to try and make sense of these turbulent times from a heathen perspective. Visit fergan.com for links, information and an archive of past episodes. So, we've reached episode number 3 of the Fergan podcast. I hope everyone has enjoyed the discussion so far. In this episode, I'd like to deviate somewhat from the first two, which served as a sort of short series in introducing curious minds to paganism. And in this episode, I'm going to speak to my very good friend, Heidrun, who some of you may have heard me speak to before. She's in America, and she has a lot of great insight into not just heathenry, but to related philosophical topics. And in this episode, we're going to talk about some subjects related to a man called Ted Kaczynski, who most of you will have heard of. But before we get into that, I'll introduce Heidrun. Hello, Heidrun. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing well. Thanks, Dan. How are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm good. Yeah, it's yeah, lots going on in life, but it's always rewarding to be able to have a good conversation at the end of the day, no matter what's no matter what your day's been like. It's good to speak with some like-minded folk and to feed the soul, so to speak.
Well, the powers that be are definitely keeping us on our toes these days, aren't they?
Yeah, they certainly are. Yeah. So Heidrun has a website that I'd implore all of you to have a look at, which is freefolk.org. Is that correct, Heidrun?
Yes, it is.
Freefolk.org. She's also going to become quite active soon with her own podcast, and she'll have an Odyssey channel and a Telegram channel, which has already started, but I believe she has some quite extensive plans for all of these things. So is that true, Heidrun? You've got some big aspirations for these things?
Well, hopefully. I've got a series I'm working on right now. As you know, I've been dealing with some health issues for the better part of the year, so I have not been as active as I would like to be, but I am working on a series, and I hope to get that started soon in terms of having something actually to show for it.
Great, yeah. Heidrun has run some of the subject matter that she's going to be discussing in her series by me, and it's going to be some really fascinating stuff. It's some subject matter which isn't commonly discussed, but should be because it's the nature of it has quite a big bearing upon the state of the world and of human society as we know it currently. But I won't spoil what she has planned by talking too much about that. But in today's,
thanks,
you're welcome, Heidrun. In this episode of the Fergan podcast, Heidrun and I have planned for quite a while now, I think months, I'd say, to discuss the subject of surrogate activity, which is a concept which was first formulated by Ted Kaczynski. So for those of you who don't know, a quick introduction, Ted Kaczynski is a man who is currently in jail. He's quite elderly, and he finds himself in jail for being, he was also known as the Unabomber. So a terrorist he was, who wrote a manifesto and several other essays opposing the post-industrial technological society. He wrote a manifesto called Industrial Society and Its Future, which is actually the only one of his works that I've read, but I did find it quite profound. And although I don't agree with the measures that he took in trying to get his views across to the world, I certainly do agree with his philosophy in general. And one of the most kind of original parts of his philosophy is he talks about two related things, which are the power process and surrogate activities. The power process leads, or lack of power process leads, to surrogate activities. So just to briefly explain this and set the scene for Heydrun and my discussion, the power process is a innate natural need that all human beings have to have some kind of activity in their life which is meaningful and benefits their life in some way. So essentially something that you are working towards, the requirement that you have to feed yourself, to for shelter, for food, for building things, for creating society or relationships or something like that, these kind of basic natural requirements that we have, and it's built into us at a kind of primal level that we actively seek these things and take a great deal of solace in doing them, that they actually they provide something psychological which we do need. And when we don't have these things, when we live in a society such as our modern one, where we don't have to provide our own food, we don't have to fight to heat our home, we don't have to fight anything or anyone really, you know, we're given such comfort through, you know, modern societal technologies, that we merely need to flick a switch and light comes on, we merely need to press a button and heating turns on. To travel great distances, we've got the comfort of cars or public transport. So essentially what Kaczynski argued was that our access to the power process has largely been taken away from us by a modern society. And as a result, we're severely lacking psychologically and perhaps spiritually. And because these things have been taken away from us, we're left with surrogate activities, which are, I think the best way that I can explain this is just by reading a pertinent passage from his manifesto. A surrogate activity is an activity that is directed towards an artificial goal that the individual pursues for the sake of the fulfillment that he gets from pursuing the goal, not because he needs to attain the goal itself. For instance, there is no practical motive for building enormous muscles, hitting a little ball into a hole, or acquiring a complete series of postage stamps. Yet many people in our society devote themselves with passion to bodybuilding, golf, or stamp collecting. Some people are more other-directed than others, and therefore will more readily attach importance to a surrogate activity simply because the people around them treat it as important, or because society tells them it is important. That is why some people get very serious about essentially trivial activities such as sports or bridge or chess or arcane scholarly pursuits, whereas others who are more clear-sighted never see these things as anything but the surrogate activities that they are, and consequently never attach enough importance to them to satisfy their need for the power process in that way. So hopefully I've given a good, although brief overview there of these concepts. And at this point, Heydrun, where can we go from here? What is it that you think needs discussing in light of these theories of Kaczynski's?
Well, first, if I may, I'd like to make an observation about what you just said. You said that these things were taken from us. I disagree with that. I think we voluntarily gave them up. We as a people have done what I call the outsourcing of responsibility for some time. And every time we outsource responsibility for something to somebody else, we voluntarily give up our power. So, for example, if I choose to go out to a restaurant this evening instead of cooking my own dinner, I'm outsourcing the responsibility of feeding myself to somebody else. And while I enjoy the comfort, convenience, and ease of that, I'm actually forfeiting my power when I do that. So I think that's an important starting point, is to be aware that this is something we as human beings voluntarily do, and as a society have voluntarily done over a long period of time, which has brought us, I think, to where we are now.
Yeah, you are right to point that out, because it speaks to an aspect of human nature. It's not that we were forced into this position. It's that there is a, unfortunately, there is a tendency within us, for whatever reason, that we, you know, perhaps we can expand on it, but there is a tendency within us to seek these kind of comforts, which, you know, we don't realize perhaps when we're seeking those comforts that it will remove something that we do desperately, subconsciously, psychologically need.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's simple animal instinct, right? Every organism wants to expend the least amount of energy necessary in order to survive and reproduce. I mean, that's essentially it. So whenever it is offered a means by which to do that, it's going to choose that over expending more energy than is necessary to achieve those goals. So that's the underlying motivation for why we do it. The problem with humans is we have the ability to build these complex artificial constructs that end up over time becoming prisons. They end up robbing us of our autonomy over time rather than benefiting us in that way. And it's because of our superior intelligence. So our intelligence is kind of a double-edged sword in that regard, right? It enables us to build these incredible civilizations and all the wonders that come with them. But it also gives us the ability to literally dig our own graves and imprison ourselves.
Yeah. And I would suggest as well that, you know, you mentioned that we have this this natural kind of inclination to seek the greatest amount of outcome for the least amount of energy expended. That's on a material level, that makes perfect sense, you know, from a survival point of view. So perhaps it's only in our spiritual aspect that the lack of power process becomes a problem. You know, perhaps if we didn't have that deeper psychological, spiritual aspect to us, perhaps our lack of power process wouldn't have become an issue in our modern times. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, I agree with you there. And I would also add psychological to that as well. It's a psychological and a spiritual need. So for example, you can have somebody who lives in a very affluent society, like here in America, where even the poorest live better than, you know, those in third world countries. And they may have all of their basic needs met, and yet they're still frustrated. They have access to food, shelter, sex, everything that they could possibly need, even entertainment. But they're still frustrated. And that's because they have psychological and spiritual needs that are not met by the material provisioning of the society. So, yeah, that's what drives us to start to look for ways to seek power and to attain goals, even if they're artificial goals.
Right. Yeah. And I think if I could also just mention for the listeners out there that the reason that Hadrian and I feel that this is an important topic to discuss is because what we're going through now, particularly over the last couple of years, I think a lot of people have really begun to question exactly what it is that matters in life, what's really significant in life. And we've been provided, probably more so over the last 2 years, more comfort and security by our governments than ever before. Yet, so if that's the case, why is it that so many of us feel so deeply disillusioned at this time? And it's because our individual agency has been taken away from us to such a degree now that there is even the threat of us having no agency over our own bodies any longer. And as particularly as heathens, as pagans, but anyone who has a longing for a more natural way of living, it's imperative that we find our way back to a way of being where we do have this power process. We do have access to that that essential aspect of our being. Go on, Hadrian.
I was just going to comment. It's an addiction. We have become dependent upon the comforts and conveniences that are provided to us by the government, by the society as a whole, by this complex social machine of which we're all a part. And just like a drug addict, now we're at the mercy of that machine. It becomes very difficult to become free of that when one becomes dependent upon it. So the first thing we have to do is we have to recognize that we're addicts, and we have to recognize what it is that we're addicted to. And then we have to ask ourselves, do we want to be free of this? And if so, to what extent? And then what are we willing to give in order to obtain that freedom? Because, you know, it's not going to come easily. You have to choose to break from the thing that you're addicted to, the thing that holds you in thrall, basically.
Yeah, and earlier on when I misspoke somewhat and said that the power process has been taken from us, I think what I was really alluding to there is the fact that although we have chosen this through our predilection to comfort and expending the least amount of energy to achieve a quality of life, at the same time, those who are holding the reins of power in this world, or in the human societal aspect of this world anyway, they know full well that we are addicted to these things. And they're, you know, much like the drug dealer who relies upon the addiction of his or her victims, that's kind of how I see the powers that be, the globalists, those who are who have the ability to unleash certain aspects of technology upon us at certain, I believe, at certain points in history, that these technologies are released in a kind of coordinated manner. Although that's a kind of pet theory of mine, which we won't necessarily go into here. But point is that although we have chosen this and our weakness has brought us to this point, there are people who are benefiting from it. Those who are in power and who seek greater power are becoming more powerful because we are handing them our personal agency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with everything you just said there. And I think we have to be fair to ourselves and recognize that we're generational addicts. It's not like we were born free.
Yeah,
and then
that's a really important point, Hadrian. Yeah, if you can expand on that, I think that's a really, really key point.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it would be one thing if we were born free and then we made the choice to give up that agency and become slaves to something or to someone. That's not the case here. I think for most of us, if not all of us, we were born into this slavery. Our parents were addicted to this. Our grandparents were addicted to this, and so on and so forth. Back many, many generations. We don't know how far back this goes. There's speculation, you know, that humans were an engineered, you know, slave race and all of that. And we could get into another discussion about that. But it goes back a long, long, long time. So not only have we been socially engineered to be slaves and addicts, but I think it's also hardwired into our DNA because this has been a part of our, you know, experience as a species for so very long.
Yeah, well, there are some who would argue, particularly from a Christian angle, that it potentially goes back to the moment that Adam and Eve were tempted by the snake in Eden, that this the serpent represents this knowledge of technology which mankind should never have had in the first place, and that perhaps everything has been cascading since that moment in time. And of course, I come from a heathen background, as does Hadrian, but neither of us are unwilling to entertain these kind of certainly symbolic or mythic ideas from other traditions as well. And, you know, these are echoed across other traditions anyway. But as Hadrian mentioned, there are theories that this kind of descent into technological slavery begins far further back than many of us would suspect. I mean, at the very least, we can point to the Industrial Revolution. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I certainly do believe that it does go further back than that. And actually, I do have a set of notes for another podcast, which perhaps Hadrian would like to do with me, which is we'll discuss the natural, the kind of the organic versus the artificial. There is a simulacra of many of these natural aspects. But that's just a hint of what may come in the future. But
Like that would be a good conversation.
I wrote down some notes while I was on tour just before COVID hit, and I read through them today, and actually I was quite pleasantly surprised by how lucid they are. So I think that would be a really good discussion, but not one for today. Mm-hmm. But this technological progress that we've seen has been accelerating at an exponential rate, and the last 2 years has seen a real consolidation in the power that grants those who seek it, as well as a severe lessening of that power that we have over our own lives among us. So that's why this is a particularly good time to discuss this topic. Is there anything, Hadrian, that you think can be said specifically on the power process, or should we move on to the outcome of that, which is surrogate activity?
Well, let's talk a little bit about what the power process is, so that folks understand how that works. So there's this desire to have a goal and then to apply effort to overcome challenges and then ultimately attain that goal. So without that process playing itself out, there's no actual psychological fulfillment. Obviously, there's no material fulfillment, but the chemical reaction in the brain doesn't occur by which one gets that psychological fulfillment. So it has to follow that process. And in terms of gender, that's a masculine process. That's what we call actualization. Men tend to be more advantaged in this than women are, but that doesn't mean that women can't also experience this, and they do experience this. It's just that men tend to have a greater capacity for actualization in the world. What the powers that be, or I should say our slavers or deceivers, whatever you want to call them, the ones who have gotten us addicted to their drug of dependence, what they've done is they have feminized us. They have made us dependent. They have said, look, we're going to take care of all of your needs for you. You don't need to do anything. You just let us make you comfortable. And we gave them our consent. And when I say we, I obviously mean us as a species going back however many generations. But in doing that, we allowed that masculine impetus to self-actualize, to become stunted or blunted altogether. And then eventually, just like a muscle that you don't exercise, it atrophies. Okay. And I think that's where a lot of us are finding ourselves now. We don't know how to self-actualize in the world. Now, in some cases, we may actually be so disadvantaged that we really can't find a way to self-actualize. But I think in a lot of cases, we can if we look for opportunities in our lives. But we've become lazy, so we just look for ways to sort of, you know, LARP, and this is where we get into the surrogate activities. Instead of applying the real effort that would make real change in our real lives, we do something that doesn't require that amount of effort or risk. We do something that's safe. We do something that requires less energy, but it sort of gives us this simulation of success, right? Like the guy who maybe opts for the pornography in the video game instead of actually making himself a fitter, more competitive man who can go out there and achieve success in business and in relationships with women. Okay, that's one example.
Yeah, so this is why initiation rites and coming of age rites have been so important throughout human history, because those are essentially the tools by which we teach young men and young women to find their purpose in life and how to actualize, right?
Yes, and if I may comment briefly and then you can continue. Purpose is vitally important for men. I mean, it's important for women too, but more so men, you know, young males, boys, men, they need to have purpose in life. For a woman, it's more important that she feel loved and appreciated and protected and safe. Men really need to have a purpose. Without that, they do not do well.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, speaking from my own personal experience and with my marriage, I would actually say that my wife, she did need a purpose, and being a mother provided that purpose. But I think there is a distinct difference between that purpose, which is generally quite universal to women. The default purpose of most women is to be a mother, whereas I think the purpose among men can vary a lot more. But
if I may,
yeah, sure.
Speaking of the maternal in specific, that's an instinct, that's a natural inclination that most women have. Obviously, there are some exceptions, but most women, they just are naturally inclined to the domestic sphere, to being a wife and a mother and a homemaker and taking care of the kids and educating the kids and all of that, mm-hmm. supporting their husband.
Yeah.
But when we're talking about purpose, we're talking about having to go out and seek something and find it. Okay. That's a much more masculine thing. And I'm being explicit here by saying masculine and not men, because women can have this too, but it's actually going out and seeking something. Okay. And you have to find it. You have to find your purpose. The natural inclination towards motherhood, that's more of an instinct. A woman doesn't have to go out and seek that and discover that. It's something that's in her innately.
Right. And that's kind of written in stone the day that a woman is born. That one day she will become a mother, and that will be her primary purpose in life. Whereas when a male is born, it's not, unless he is the heir to some kind of dynasty or some kind of particular vocation or something, his destiny is not necessarily written.
Well, even then, I mean, whatever his social or economic conditions are, don't dictate necessarily what his purpose is. He still must discover his purpose. That's part of the hero's journey. That's part of the young male going out into the wilderness and discovering himself by meeting challenges in nature. And that reveals to him what he is. That's very much part of that process. Yeah.
Yeah, and interesting. I think that's a good segue to a passage that I wanted to read of Kaczynski's here, mm-hmm. which is, history shows that leisured aristocracies tend to become decadent. This is not true of fighting aristocracies that have to struggle to maintain their power, but leisured, secure aristocracies that have no need to exert themselves usually become bored, hedonistic, and demoralized, even though they have power. This shows that power is not enough. One must have goals towards which to exercise one's power. And the reason I wanted to read that passage out is because what strikes me about that is that we kind of jump from this this problem of a lack of power process amongst individuals and the havoc that can wreak psychologically upon the individual, as in that individual may become depressed, probably will lose interest in maintaining themselves physically in terms of their health and things like that. But when we're talking about an aristocracy losing that power process, that has far wider implications. So that even if the subjects of that aristocracy, the lower classes, who are largely and perhaps unfortunately, their destiny is dictated by that aristocracy. If that aristocracy falls into meaninglessness, into triviality, then that essentially leads potentially an entire nation into meaninglessness and triviality.
Well, absolutely, because the aristocracy is the head. It's the father of the family. It's the head of the organism. So if that fails or is severed from the body in some way, then yes, the entire organism is going to fail. And unfortunately, when these things happen, it typically requires an entire collapse of that organism, and then something new has to come up out of it.
Yeah, and I would say that that's where we've been for quite a while. So we can certainly take our share of the blame for as individuals for falling down this falling into this trap. Generationally, of course, you know, we as Hadrian pointed out, we're not. This isn't something unique to the current generations. This is something that we have inherited from previous ones, and I would say that with each generation, the amount of technology that creates comfort increases. Therefore, the temptation to move further away from the power process increases with each generation. But for the last, probably in the Western world, probably for at least the last century or two, we have had an aristocracy who have had no need to exert themselves, and because of that they have become bored, hedonistic, and perhaps mischievous even. Due to that, it could be that, you know, much of the corruption and the misdeeds that we see in these kind of elite, and I use that word, you know, reservedly, mm-hmm. but these elite families, a lot of the corruption and the degeneracy that we see amongst them could be a result of the fact that they are descended from go-getters. They are descended from families who and fathers who did have this spirit of actualization, but because they found it and because that wealth became intergenerational, the modern inheritors of that have nothing to do but find trouble for themselves and for the people that they have influence over.
Right. Yeah. The failure always occurs, I find, within a single generation. There's one man who makes his fortune, or was required by his father to earn his fortune or earn his inheritance, who chooses not to do the same with his son. In other words, he chooses to simply bequeath to the son rather than require the son to actually have to earn. And once that occurs, that sets this degenerative process in motion. And you usually don't come back from that until that family has been completely bankrupted and somebody has to literally, you know, start over from having hit bottom.
I can't fault that observation. And I say that from personal experience. I grew up in in a middle class, place and time, I guess. But I had many friends in my teenage years and my 20s who were more, I would say, upper middle class, who just by virtue of coming from quite wealthy families. And exactly as you said there, Hadrian, this was wealth that was earned within a single generation by usually by boomer parents. And in one specific instance that I can mention, a friend of mine, he, because his parents were so wealthy and because they were so doting, they simply handed him everything that he wanted on a platter. He had access to their bank accounts. When he first learned to drive, they bought him a brand new car. In the time that I've known him, I think he's probably had two, maybe three jobs, each of which he's lasted no more than a month at each. And the only reason that he found those jobs was because he obviously sensed in himself that he needed some kind of purpose, not because his parents encouraged him to find work whatsoever. And he actually this friend of mine has spent several years in and out of rehab for various addictions, cocaine and alcohol addictions. And there have been several times where I genuinely thought that the next time I would hear from or well, not from, but about him would be that he had committed suicide or he had overdosed. He is a textbook example of what Hayden just mentioned. He had no, absolutely no power process whatsoever. And that impacted him psychologically so deeply that he was actually miserable. He had all the money that anyone could want or think that they could want, but it didn't make him happy. And he struggled to find a meaningful relationship with a woman. He struggled to find a home where he felt settled. He's actually quite a talented guy, musically, and a charismatic guy, a very nice guy when he wasn't in the depths of his addictions. And he could have done great things, but because he was bequeathed this, essentially his father's wealth, he never found that power process, and he never met his potential.
Yeah, that's a really tragic story, and unfortunately, it's all too common in recent generations. There's a window of opportunity, you know, between the ages of 7 and 29 for males, where they need to be taken from their mothers. In fact, they used to be physically taken from their mothers, you know, around the age of puberty. I'm talking about in, you know, our distant ancestry, where they would physically be taken from their mothers by the males of the tribe, who were usually, you know, dressed up as, you know, gods or ghosts or something. And they were taken out in the wilderness. They were blindfolded. They were afforded no way of getting back to the village, to the home and the comforts of civilization. They were out in the scary wilderness with these men. And there they had to stay and progress these tests of manhood, or else they couldn't go back. You know, that's how we get these stories about the Manorbund and whatnot, and these wild men living out in the forest. Because if they couldn't master these skills, they couldn't come back to the village, because they weren't men, and they certainly weren't going to be allowed back as sexually mature boys, you know, who were psychologically and spiritually still children, and they were unfit for service, quite frankly, as part of the tribe. They would have been a threat to the tribe. They would have been a threat to the women. They would have been unproductive. They would have been
a burden.
Not just a burden, they would have been a threat. These types of males tend to become problem males because they do not attract wives. Women are not interested in marrying men like that. So these males tend to get sexually frustrated because they're not successful with women, and they're not successful in their careers because they have no work ethic. They don't know how to confront they're conflict avoidant. They don't know how to confront adversity. They don't know how to stand their ground. They don't know how to work within an hierarchical structure. So you can't have them as part of your society. Okay. They become criminal. Or in some cases, if they're particularly passive, as you say, they become a burden. They may not necessarily create problems of violence within your society, but they're going to drain your resources. They're not going to be productive. So this was our solution, you know, in the elder days, is these boys were taken by the fathers of the tribe when they were coming into puberty, and they were made into men, or else they were left out there in the wilderness to you know, scratch their own living out there. We don't do that anymore. You know, and I think this has been by design. I'm not going to say that it was necessarily done maliciously, but, you know, I think parents wanted to just make it easier for their kids. You know, they didn't want their kids to have to work hard. They wanted their kids to supposedly have better than they had. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I was running at the.
I think that ties actually very neatly back into the point you were making about the feminine psychology earlier, because one thing that you'll notice, you know, especially those of you that are you know, family men or family women, obviously we all come from families, but a mother's basic natural instinct is to make their children as comfortable as possible. That's essentially their entire concern. You know, when the child hurts themselves, they you know, they want to heal them. They want to wrap them up and you know, protect them, put them somewhere warm and safe. A mother very rarely thinks in the longer term about the psychology of what that will do to the child if done to excess.
Right.
You see what I mean?
Absolutely. And that is appropriate and necessary up until a certain age. And we used to know when by observing the child, you know, like when a child would get their adult teeth, that was typically when it was about time for the dad to take over. You know, right. The mother has completed the primary care and education of the child. The child's been properly socialized. The child is now old enough and large enough. They can start to take on some responsibility. They can start to cut their teeth, start to take on some challenges and, you know, have to face some difficult things. And for boys particularly, this is absolutely essential. If this process does not start about that time when the adult teeth come in, that boy is going to be at best behind his peers. And at worst, he will never initiate into manhood. And he will either become a problem for society in terms of criminality, or he will become a problem for society as a burden.
And this becomes a dangerously compounding effect, doesn't it? So when we talk about how far back this goes, we could probably take a stab at it and say that it was around the time when these initiatory processes stopped occurring regularly within a society, because at that point the male would remain within society without a sense of a power process, without that sense of actualization, and would become the problem that Hadrian has just described. And then they would have children of their own. That man would have a son of his own, and of course he wouldn't put that son into the initiatory process that he should have been put into. And it gets worse and worse with each generation until we find ourselves in 2022, where most so-called men have been walking around wearing face nappies for the last 18 months.
Yes, or they don't know. They don't know what sex they are. They're playing dress up, and exactly.
Or they've spent more time with pornography than they have with women.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you know, I think at this point we can move on to specifically surrogate activities. So surrogate activities are the activities that we find in our modern times to fill this gap, this void that's left by a lack of power process. So, yes, as Kaczynski, he described bodybuilding and stamp collecting and sports and things like that. And I mean, when I read that passage, I do think to myself, well, surely there is room for sport, because sport can serve a purpose beyond being a surrogate activity. It's good, you know, competition has always been an important part, particularly among males in society. And that's a very natural thing that has occurred since the dawn of mankind.
Yes, but,
go on.
Where I draw the line when it comes to sports is it training or is it entertainment? Okay, so let's say a guy is part of a boxing league or martial arts. Maybe he's a Muay Thai fighter, or maybe he trains at firearms and goes shooting, something like that. To me, that's training. Okay. He is engaging in a physical activity that has a purpose, a useful purpose. Okay.
Yeah.
But if he's just kicking the ball around with his buddies and he's not really training his mind and his body to be a better fighter or to be a better hunter or something like that. It's just entertainment. And certainly if it's a spectator sport, I mean, these guys who think that they are somehow making a difference by yelling at the television set as they're watching, you know, a football game, obviously there's nothing in that. That's an extreme form of surrogate activity. They're living vicariously through, you know, somebody on a screen playing a game in another country or something.
Yeah, no, that's very true. And, you know, if we look back throughout human history, the two kind of most vital physical, the two most vital demonstrations of physical prowess have been the martial arts, you know, the art of war and combat and hunting. And there are a great deal of sports which you know, in the playing of, in the performance of, do actually train the body to become better at fighting or hunting. I mean, obviously there are the more direct ones of archery or firearms training, but things like you know, perhaps javelin throwing. You know, in fact, I mean, we can probably make a clear distinction by pointing to the original Olympic Games, because those Olympic Games were all sports which were somehow related to the natural inclination towards hunting and war.
Well, that's just it. You know, we were much closer to the natural world back then. We've become very removed from it in the modern day.
Mm. But I mean, definitely things like stamp collecting and, you know, something yeah. that's quite kind of relevant to me and my friend group, I would say. And by the way,
you're stamp collectors.
close enough, vinyl collectors. And, you know, this isn't, I'm not immune to this, and I don't think Hadrian would claim to be completely immune to any of this either.
I have my collections too.
we've all got our vices, our collections. We've all grown up with certain surrogate activities which we are probably still convinced are meaningful to us. I've got several friends who, well, not just several, I would say most of my friends are deeply into collecting vinyl. And, you know, on one hand, of course, music is a wonderful thing that does bring a great deal of joy to life. But when you consider that you could listen to that, you could have that music as a digital file that you've purchased from a website these days, or you could have even a CDR that you've copied from a CD or just a CD. There is actually no need to have that music on vinyl. Yes, it does sound better. Yes, the experience is better. But the obsessive levels that some people go to have a comprehensive collection of, you know, rare original pressings and things like this, that is, well, I mean, I would say it's almost worse than stamp collecting because, well, for a start, it takes up an enormous amount more room and probably money, I would say. I can't imagine there are many stamps out there that cost, you know, £200, which is what vinyl collectors will often pay for a record of a first pressing. So, right, but, I mean, sorry, go
but
on.
But choosing to have the vinyl record over the digital recording speaks to something important here. There's obviously a desire there to have something tangible.
Yeah.
And I think that speaks to a lot of us who collect things. We want something that's beautiful and tangible, something that connects us in some way to the natural world, whereas the digital does not do that for us.
Yeah, no, I do agree, and that is a good point. I mean, that's kind of, we could have kind of cross discussions on these two points because they almost conflict with one another. What I would say to that is that I think there is an aspect of vinyl collecting which is which does feed a more natural subconscious need, you know, as you just alluded to. But when we talk about collecting something physical, what a man really should in his natural state be doing is collecting food, is collecting weaponry, is collecting tools, things which can have a real meaningful long-term effect on the security of his family and his tribe. But because we don't need to do those things, because we're not expected to defend our family or our tribe, because we're not expected to be able to repair our properties or our vehicles or things ourselves, there's someone that we can always pay in meaningless fiat currency to do these things. So we're left with this kind of void where we feel like we should be collecting something, but we don't know what, because everything that we would naturally be collecting is provided for us.
Right. But just to be clear, we choose to outsource those responsibilities every time. Yeah. That we do that, we are making a choice. Now, it may be an unconscious choice because we have been so socially conditioned, you know, to, for example, you know, calling the plumber to come fix the leaky faucet as opposed to doing it ourselves. You know, we have YouTube at our disposal. We could, you know, watch a 30-minute video tutorial how to fix the faucet and go get some tools and do it ourselves. Things like this, we've just been so conditioned. Now, in some cases, it simply makes more sense, right? I might ask myself, okay, is it worth my time to, let's say, change the oil in my car when my time is worth more per hour, you know, that I could be billing to clients for whatever work I do versus what I'm going to pay the mechanic to change my oil. Okay, that's an economic decision. So, you know, if your time is that valuable, if you command, you know, that much more per hour for your skills, your knowledge, whatever it is you do for a living, then it makes sense to do that. But for a lot of us, you know, we're just making choices out of convenience, and we need to be honest with ourselves about that and recognize, okay, when I do this, I am choosing to outsource that responsibility and with it my power. Am I okay with that? And am I okay with the consequences of that for me and for my society?
Yeah, the interesting thing about what you just said is that when you pass that logically, what we end up with is that those who earn more than a tradesperson earns for their time, those people who earn more than tradespeople are the people that will be outsourcing those activities. So it follows that they are the people who will lose that power process, who will lose that connection to the meaningful activities of a man or woman in their natural state. And I think we can see that quite clearly in the modern time, where those who are kind of, you know, desk jockeys or, you know, who white collar workers are the ones who don't, well, regularly are the ones who do have the psychological problems, are the ones who are suffering from depression, who are overweight because they've lost that self-esteem that comes with having access to the power process, because they earn so much more than the man who could come and change their oil for them or tile their kitchen for them or whatever. It's cost effective for them to outsource that to someone else. So we're kind of living in this society where everyone balances their own time against those of other people. But if you're balancing your own time against someone who actually is engaging in something close to the power process, something more physical and more directly meaningful, then you're going to lose out if your time is worth more than theirs. And that's, I think that's how we've ended up with this, this society of well-earning but weak men.
Mm-hmm. Now I use tradespeople in my examples there, but I want to be very careful here to not make this sound like tradespeople don't have value. Okay.
No, not because, at all. I mean, far from it. I would argue the opposite. In fact,
I was going to go there. The economic value is determined by the market. Okay. And we just happen to be in a market right now where, let's say, a software engineer or, you know, a game engine developer because he has rare skills, you know, in calculus and whatnot. His intelligence demands more, commands more rather in terms of value than, say, your general contractor, handyman, whomever. But however, you know, that said, if our civilization collapsed tomorrow, which it very well could, given the way things are going, the guy who is developing software or building video game engines would be worthless. There would be no market for him because the entire economy for that would be gone. But the guy who can actually tile your floor or, you know, fix your toilet or put a roof on your house would suddenly be in demand, and he would be able to command more value. So it's all determined by whatever economy that you're in. I just used those as an example because I know people who've done that. They could change the oil in their car, but because, you know, they bill $100 an hour for their time in some technological field, it doesn't make sense for them to do so.
Well, I mean, using the example of tradespeople is makes perfect sense, because a tradesman is engaging in timeless work that it is not the whim of some kind of, you know, current fashion and industry, you know, trend in industry or
in
technology. They're engaging in work which is beyond that, which is timeless. And this, it should be said, is exactly why Ted Kaczynski felt that he needed to try and physically destroy this industrial society. Not just write about it, but he actually was actively going about trying to destroy it, because he knew that only in doing so could people who still have a grasp of the power process actually find some kind of prominence in society, and that those who don't have a grasp of the power process could rediscover it. Only in that kind of post-collapse scenario could everyone rediscover their power process.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think we have to worry about that. I think it will destroy itself. These things tend to be self-consuming over time. I mean, we might not live to see it, but I think ultimately it is going to devour itself.
I would like to think so, but I can't help thinking that those who hold the reins of power at the moment are well aware of that. They know what would happen if they allow society to collapse to that level. They know that real men and, you know, women with agency too would rediscover their nature, and with it a sense of power that could threaten the current powers.
Yeah, they do tend to keep everyone just comfortable enough that they don't pursue actualization. They tend to be very good at that, but then they psychologically know us better than we know ourselves. That's part of the problem.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'd like to leave folks with some takeaways from this, you know, because we are so well provided for by our societies. I mean, even though we may be poor, even though we may not have all the luxuries that we would want, believe me, we're far well taken care of than our ancestors were. We really don't have to exert that much effort in order to get our basic needs met. So if we want to have more agency, we actually have to work at it. We have to make the decision each day that we're going to do difficult things in order to provide ourselves with that purpose and give ourselves that power. We have to take it back. We gave it away. We have to take it back. And that's a choice that we make every single day.
Yeah. No, thank you for, you know, ending with that, because, you know, as regular listeners and followers of the Fergan on Telegram will know, the whole purpose of what I'm doing is to try and collectively for us to find some kind of solution to the problems that we're facing, particularly over the last 2 years in this post-COVID age. So there's no use in discussing these things philosophically. And actually, ironically, this is something that Ted Kaczynski mentions himself, is that some people have such a lack of access to the power process that one of the surrogate activities that they find is meaningless intellectualizing and scholarly pursuits. And I think a lot of people in our kind of dissident sphere have fallen prey to that, where mm-hmm. they think that they are somehow standing as a solution to the problems we're facing, but actually all they're doing is indulging their own wants and needs, the void that they lack within themselves. You know, perhaps they should in another life have been some kind of leader, some kind of military strategist or something, but because they don't have access to those kind of roles, they instead end up spending hours and hours every week talking over the heads of most people on podcasts and videos. And I hope that Hayden and I haven't done that with this one. I don't think we have. I think what we're laying out here is both philosophically important, but also practically meaningful, because as Hayden just mentioned, the only person that can get you out of this trap of surrogate activity is you. There is literally no what you can't be pulled out of it, because you need to decide for yourself what it is that you're doing with your time, which is filling a void of meaningless, and what you can replace that with that is meaningful. For example, a few years ago, I had a go at tiling my dining room floor. Now, I think I got a quote for doing it that was something like £300 or something, not very much money. And then I proceeded to spend basically an entire week doing it myself, and therefore sacrificing more money than it would have cost me to pay someone else to do it. But I'm glad I did it, because it gave me a sense of meaning and purpose for that week, instead of sitting in front of a computer, you know, shuffling emails about, which, you know, some of my work involves. I was actually doing something directly to better my household and my family's existence. And I'm sure all of us, including Hayden, can give examples of something that we've done that has given us that feeling of fulfillment. And we should always be mindful of when we feel that, when we feel at the end of a day that we've done something meaningful. And remember it and think about what did we do that day that gave us that sense of fulfillment, because we have a natural instinct for what activities are meaningful in our lives and which ones are a waste of time. We all know those days when we have probably wasted more hours than we would care to admit doing something that in the end was completely trivial.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you and I are very solutions oriented. You know, I listen to your podcast and you always try to provide solutions, you know, not just a positive mindset, but to give somebody a takeaway. And I try to do the same. And I think I think that's what sets us apart from those who are just doomsayers. They just want to talk about how bad things are and here's all the doom and gloom. Or as you say, they want to intellectualize everything. That's not useful. You know, when people listen to that, they're not getting anything useful. You know, it's just a bunch of masturbation or entertainment or to some extent nihilism if they want to immerse themselves in all that doom and gloom. But when you give somebody something constructive that they can take away and put into practice, now they have a tool. Now they have something they can use to make their lives better. And what I would suggest to people who are struggling with this, and maybe feeling frustrated because they are lacking actualization in their lives, because I've suffered with this too. Pick something difficult to do each day. One thing. Pick something you don't want to do. Okay, maybe you don't like to exercise. Make a commitment to yourself and say, okay, I'm going to engage in a physical activity for 30 minutes today. It could be anything. Take a walk, lift weights, whatever you like to do, ride a bike. Pick something, you know, my house is a mess. Okay, I'm going to clean one room. Just pick one room and clean that room. you will find over time, as you continue to make this commitment to yourself and keep this commitment to yourself each day, not only does it get easier, but you start to feel more fulfilled in your life. Just little things. But you have to keep that commitment. So choose something that you know that you can do and that you will keep the commitment to yourself to do, because it'll set up a chain of events. And if you're depressed, just get out of the house. Seriously, if you're depressed, go take a walk. Go get out in the sunlight and the fresh air. Move your body. You will feel better.
Yeah. And I think it's important to point out that there are kind of levels to this. There are stages of progress with this. You know, for example, some people may, order takeaway food far too often.
Cook a meal.
You know, and even though, you know, as I say, there are layers. So even though you haven't actually sourced that food yourself, you've not grown those vegetables necessarily, you've not actually hunted and killed that slab of meat, it's still a step up from ordering ready-made food delivered to your door.
Exactly.
I would argue is something that we should be doing as little as possible, and just take back that sense of agency in steps, in stages. You know, go from ordering food to be delivered to making your own food, and then from there you can move on to growing your own food, perhaps even slaughtering your own animals.
Every step that you take, it's going to take back some of that agency, and over time you will have more agency. You will literally be a different person than you are now.
And I guarantee that, you know, when I do that, I genuinely feel happier. You know, it's not just a platitude to say that. This isn't me just kind of grasping things out of thin air. I genuinely feel happier when I've done things which are have more of a direct impact on my well-being in a practical sense. And I'm sure Hadrian would agree.
Oh, yes, I do too. In fact, recently, one of the things that I did is I replaced my morning meal with 30 minutes of prayer. So I do 30 minutes of prayer and meditation every morning now instead of a morning meal. And that has so many benefits for me because it orders my mind. It's also providing me some intermittent fasting. It just sets me up for the rest of my day. And I have found...
That's a great idea. Sorry, yeah. It's a great idea. Yeah. Really good.
Yeah. And I have found that my day goes much better no matter what confrontations I have to contend with in my day, you know, if it's a difficult client or what have you. Just that little step has made quite a difference in my overall just day-to-day headspace and health.
Great. Well, I think we've been through everything there that I can think to talk about. So unless, Hadrian, have you got anything else to add at the end here?
No, I think everybody's heads are probably pretty full at this point.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you so much for joining me on this. And there will definitely be more episodes of the Fergan podcast with Hadrian, because she and I have got some you know, we've had some good discussions in the past. Most of them weren't recorded. So hopefully we can get some on record for the future.
Absolutely. It's always a pleasure, Dan. Thanks so much for inviting me. I love talking to your audience. And if I can be of any help to anybody, they can reach out to me now that I've got the website up and all that. So,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, make sure that you check out freefolk.org. And Hadrian is just at the beginning of a process of kind of rolling out her repertoire, so to speak, her Odyssey channel, her podcast, and more posts from her Telegram channel. And I know that it's going to be some really good stuff coming out there. And anyone who doesn't know, there is a website for this podcast, which is fergen.com, which is fyrgen.com. And on there you can find links to my Odyssey Telegram channels, as well as my Patreon websites, Substack, Patreon, and Subscribestar, and a few others. And you can also listen to the latest podcast there. And this podcast weekly goes out first to subscribers, and a week later will go out for free for everyone to listen to. Thank you, Hadrian, and good night.
Thank you, Dan. Have a good one.
I hope all of you enjoyed that discussion with Hadrian. So now it's time for the riddle section. For those of you who don't know, I've been reading a riddle from the Exeter Riddle Book each episode of the podcast. So in the last episode, I read riddle number 2, or the second riddle from that book that I've chosen. And some of you have made some guesses and some of you are correct. But these are quite sophisticated riddles. And I think that, you know, if ever proof were needed that our ancestors weren't, you know, dribbling wrecks, then these riddles are that, because they're far more poetic and, you know, deeply kind of symbolic and cleverly worded than, you know, anything that the vast majority of modern minds could come up with, I would say. So anyway, the answer to last week's riddle was either a submarine earthquake or a storm at sea. So now it's time for the next riddle for episode number 3. And here we go. Sometimes my lord corners me. Then he imprisons all that I am under fertile fields. He frustrates me, condemns me in my might to darkness, casts me into a cave where my warden, Earth, sits on my back. I cannot break out of that dungeon, but I shake halls and houses. The gabled homes of men tremble and totter. Walls quake, then overhang. Air floats above earth, and the face of the ocean seems still until I burst out from my cramped cell at my lord's bidding. He who in anger buried me before, so shackled me that I could not escape my guardian, my guide. Sometimes I swoop to whip up waves, rouse the water, drive the flint-grey rollers to the shore. Spuming crests crash against the cliff, dark precipice looming over deep water, a second tide, a sombre flood, follows the first. Together they fret against the sheer face, the rocky coast. Then the ship is filled with the yells of sailors. The cliffs quietly abide the ocean's froth and fury, lashing waves, racing rollers that smash against stone. The ship must face a savage battle, a bitter struggle. If the sea so buffets it and its cargo of souls that it is no longer under control, but, fighting for life, rides foaming on the spines of breakers. There men see the terror I must obey when I bluster on my way. Who shall restrain it? At times I rush through the dark clouds that ride me, churn the sea into a frenzy, then afterwards let the water subside. When one cloud collides with another, edge against sharp edge, the din of destruction, a mighty noise echoes above the dwellings of men. Dark bodies, hastening, breathe fire overhead. Flashing lightning, thunderous crashes, shake the sky, then growl darkly. The clouds do combat, dark drops fall, rustling rain from their wombs. A fear tide flows in the hearts of men, a growing terror. Strongholds succumb to dread when that ghastly troop goes on the rampage and shrithing evil spirits, spurting flames, shoot sharp weapons. A fool is unafraid of the death spears, but for all that he will die if the true lord lets fly the arrow. A whistling weapon straight through rain from the whirlwind above. Few men survive if they are struck by lightning. I am the origin of all that strife. When I rush through the concourse of clouds, surge forward with great strength and fly over the face of the water. Troops on high clash noisily, then afterwards, under cover of night, I sink to earth and carry off some burden on my back. Renewed once more by my lord's power, I am a mighty servant, sometimes. I fight, sometimes wait under the earth. At times I swoop and sink underwater, at times whip up waves from above. Sometimes I rise, stir up trouble, amongst scudding clouds, swift and savage, I travel widely. Tell me my name, and who it is rouses me from my rest, or who restrains me when I remain silent.